for joining us today. It's the 10th of June, 2018. This is Virtual Saguaro. Thanks for dropping by. Hope you like that Indian music intro, because it leads into our guest today. Ruchika is from Delhi, India. Ruchika has been volunteering to teach English in Cambodia these last several months. We had an opportunity to discuss her country, some recent experiences, her country's views, as well as her personal views of what a big fat Indian wedding is all about. Join Anne and myself as we listen in to an interview recorded from the teacher's house in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, with various city sounds in the background. So here is Ruchika. Temperature's been affecting all three of us for the last 3 months.
Yeah.
And
big time.
Why on earth are three strangers? What are we doing in Phnom Penh, Cambodia? How did you get here, Ruchika?
So I wanted to take out time from work and volunteer at a place. And I'd been toying with the idea for over a year. And I'd found a couple of NGOs in India, but it just never seemed to work out somehow. And then I'd reached a point where I thought I only want to work in the development sector, so I wanted to take time off work and see if I can get some opportunities there. And then I came across this 3 month volunteer program, and I was fortunate enough to get a sabbatical, get some time off work and come here and live here for 3 months and teach English to a bunch of Cambodians who have probably not studied English ever in school. And I'm not a qualified English teacher. All I know is how to speak in English, because fortunately we studied English in school and we speak a lot of it at home. And while growing up, all the movies and the cartoons that I used to see were English, and all the storybooks we read were English.
Bugs Bunny,
Tom and Jerry. Tom and Jerry didn't have a lot of speaking, but Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, all the Disney movies that we watched were in English.
Introduce our listeners to where Delhi is. I think most people know that India is kind of shaped like an arrowhead or a point going down. Yeah, with some very large mountains at the north, surrounded by some water. Help us a little more with where is Delhi.
Delhi is in the northern part of India. It is, but it is quite far away from the mountains, so it's in the plains, which is why I think it gets really hot. I still wouldn't say that Delhi is the hottest part of India. I think there are some cities and some parts of the country which could be hotter than Delhi as well. And the good thing, though, is that we don't get a lot of humidity because it's landlocked. And another good thing is that while we might have very hot summers, we also have a good 2.5-3 months of good winter, where the temperature goes down to 0 degrees and sometimes -1, -2 at night. So yeah, we get a good balance of both climates.
It almost sounds as if it's a desert climate. You know, extremely hot in the summer and just right about freezing in the winter.
Yeah,
In southern Arizona, where we had lived, there was several exactly the same climate.
Yeah.
But maybe not as extreme temperature.
Yeah. Also, during the summer, it doesn't cool down even at night. Mm. So we have a lot of hot winds blowing, which make people sick. So you're very prone to getting a heat stroke when you're walking around outside. Mm. So at certain times of the year, the government does issue a warning to stay indoors and not go outside between 12 p.m. and 4 p.m. because the winds are hot.
Well, we're all here in Cambodia for 3 months, and we're working for an organization called Volunteer in Cambodia, and the offshoot is Conversations with Foreigners. So there are about 12 or 13 teachers here for 3 months, and we're all teaching English and learning to survive in Cambodia, and it's been a really interesting experience. We're coming to the end of our time here.
Okay, I've heard there's something very special about this particular school because they take a huge percentage of their profits from the tuition of the students and do something with it. What is it that they do?
Well, the money that they get after expenses goes to the rural areas. And so they partner with different NGOs and they work in water sanitation and education and women and children's health. So they do a lot of good outreach. It's a very interesting model.
I've heard that you took a trip somewhere to see some of the usages of this money in Cambodia.
So we went to see a water purification project where we saw how they collect groundwater, which is poisoned with arsenic, and purify it. There are a couple of steps. They showed us all the steps, how they purify it. And that clean drinking water then goes to a nearby school, free of cost, where each classroom gets a 20-liter bottle of clean drinking water every day. And they also sell these water bottles at a nominal price, which is lower than the market price, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And so people have access to clean drinking water. A couple of problems that they said they faced were that the water tastes different because it's been purified. Sometimes they have to regulate the amount of chlorine that they put in it because the people in the villages think that there's something wrong with the water and don't want to drink it, despite knowing that it's cleaner and purer than the groundwater that they're getting. So they don't trust technology. It's, I think, another reason. One reason for that is probably lack of education, that they don't trust technology. They don't trust things which are new and different.
Sure. It's changing.
Yeah.
As a developing country. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even when we travel different places, if the water tastes funny, you kind of question it for a little moment or two. Then there's a huge volume of bottled water now on our planet. And so you see the evidence of people not trusting even major Western countries. You're drinking bottled water because you don't trust what's there. This discussion is making me thirsty. Go.
About the Indian food?
Yeah, you're eating some Indian food here in Nampa.
Yeah, and
you're a pretty tough cookie out here.
So when we came to Phnom Penh and during orientation, when we were told that each of you is going to have a runny stomach and it's not possible that you don't have a runny stomach, and Louisa said that if one of you survives this program without getting a runny stomach, then you will get a prize or whatever she said. And I was like, you know what? I am totally going to survive this, because what these Westerners don't understand is that I'm from India, and that any bacteria that might exist here has already probably passed through my system at some point in my life and blah, blah, blah. So I was overconfident. And as with most things that we are overconfident about, my first encounter with Indian food led to a stomach bug which lasted for a few days, and as did my second and third encounter with Indian food before I realized that I should not eat Indian food outside. And that's the funny thing, even back at home, when we even in India, when we go out and we go to these Indian restaurants, and the thing with Indian food is, I think everyone just ends up ordering a lot, so you end up overeating. And maybe it is the oil or the spices that I used, but it takes a few days for me to recover from Indian food, restaurant-made Indian food, even back at home, because it's heavy.
Yeah.
And the way that these things are cooked at home are slightly different. So I know it's really funny for you that an Indian doesn't want to eat Indian food or falls ill eating Indian food outside.
But you're looking forward to home-cooked Indian food.
Oh, yeah, that I am, yes.
We do a lot of talking at dinner. We live in a volunteer house, and there are five of us here, and we get back after class at about 8 o'clock at night, and we all have dinner, and so there's always different stories that come up. And one of the stories that we found really interesting was this particular suburb that you live in has some interesting liquor stores or wine shops.
So,
okay, readers, now this is a true story. Listen to it with some patience. Don't expect to duplicate this in your local neighborhood.
So the suburb of Delhi that I live in is called Gurgaon, and over the last couple of years, I have seen a surge. When I say a surge, I mean an epidemic in the number of liquor stores that are open. You know, I used to hear people joke about how there's a Starbucks at every corner in the United States. Trust me, there is a liquor store at every corner in my city. And when I say a liquor store, it is the size of a showroom. It will, I would say it is the size of a grocery store, and lit up like a grocery store with different aisles and categories of wines and whiskeys. And when you go in, some of the liquor stores, the guy will come speak to you in English, suggest what wine you should buy, and then you can be on your way. And it's come to a point where you could be living anywhere in the city and you will have a liquor store at walking distance. You do not need to get into your car. And if you are too lazy to walk, they will deliver.
So you can,
whenever you go and buy, you
is
ask
lazy
them.
Lazy or inebriated?
Either. So you can ask them if they deliver, and sometimes they'll say, okay, if you order within a certain amount or over a certain amount, then we'll deliver. And sometimes when you hesitate, as they say that, they say, okay, never mind, you order whatever you want, I'll just come and deliver.
All right, now, is there, you mentioned a relationship between the liquor store and some of the nightclubs. How does that work?
So it's not really a nightclub, it's like a restaurant. It's like an open-air restaurant. And some of them are not even proper restaurants, they're just sheds with tables and chairs and a small kitchen. So you go in, you buy your whatever you want to drink from the liquor store, and you go into that restaurant, and you can only drink the liquor bought from the liquor store outside that restaurant at that restaurant. So I can't bring my own liquor from home and drink it there, unless you can sneak it in, which is also possible. But so you go in there and you pay for a glass, you pay for ice, you pay for Coca-Cola or sparkling water or tonic or whatever you want to mix with your drinks, and water if you want. And you can order snacks like French fries or finger food. You can also, some of the places some of those places have a lot of good food, like really delicious food. And and then you can stay there till the cops decide to come and shut the place down. Sometimes they come at 12, sometimes they come at 3. It depends on what kind of a day it is.
You've only heard by rumor that it's 3 o'clock. You've never been there at 3, have you?
I have, on occasion, yeah. And sometimes they would shut down the music at 12 to sort of deceive the cops, and once they're gone, then the party starts back up again.
Oh, so it wasn't that the policemen don't like alcohol being drank. It was the noise of the party.
It is the noise. It's also illegal to have a restaurant running beyond, I think, a certain time of night.
Oh,
it's illegal. So that's why they want to shut it down. Now, if the restaurant owner has paid them in advance, then they don't.
Okay, wow. I just can't imagine somebody going to Cambodia and teaching people English, much less if you're not an English teacher. And her story about the Indian food was fascinating because she got sick on her own Indian food.
Not her Indian food.
Well, no, it was a different Indian food. Different oil, she claimed.
Yeah, Indian food in the restaurants.
Right. Anyway, I'm glad that school is doing a great outreach to the community through their resources.
I hear that next we're going to talk about something that I find just fascinating, and that's all about marriage.
Oh, they do arranged marriages in that country, I hear.
Still, for some people.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So this should be really interesting.
Okay, that's great. So let's get with it.
A topic that's been interesting to us, having come from the United States, is looking at the different countries that arrange their marriages ahead of time for the young couple. Have you had any of that experience? You know, you have wonderful parents, I'm sure. Are they traditional? Are they thinking that way, that they should arrange a marriage for you? Is it changing?
So arranged marriage is a concept that's been in India for many, many, many years. And if I go back to the beginning, marriages used to be arranged by the parents when their children were just born. So that is where the concept of child marriage came from. Usually girls were married off at the age of 12 and they grew up in their husband's house. Which is why they had babies really early and so on and so forth. And even today, I think today things are changing, but my parents had an arranged marriage and my mom only knew my dad because he was my uncle's friend. He was my mom's brother's friend, and he just went and told his mother that he's seen a girl and he's interested and he wants to get married, and the parents decided everything. And my mom trusted her parents' decision so blindly that she didn't question it at all. So they'd only met a handful of times before they got married, let alone going on dates or feeling close or even being friends. I think that was just a concept that didn't exist at that time. But it's changing now. My parents are okay with me choosing my partner. They're very okay with it. They don't have any concerns about what caste he's from or what religion he's from or even what country he's from. I think it's been so long at this point, they're like, just get married to anyone. They're like, we don't care whether he's from the United States or from England or from India. I don't care. Just
get us a grandchildren.
Yes. So get us a son-in-law.
What have they done to promote your marriage?
So when I turned 25 is when they started looking for prospective grooms. And there are many ways people go about it these days. They go through friends and family, and they go through websites. So they did come across a couple of people that they liked from their perspective, but...
And they met these people online?
Some of them they met online, some of them they met through friends, and so how it works is my parents go and meet the boy and the boy's family, and they see how the family is, how the household is, and then if everything is okay and I've seen the boy's pictures and the boy has seen my pictures, we decide whether we want to talk or meet. If we're in the same city, we probably meet. And if we are in different cities, we probably talk before we meet. But that's what happens now. Earlier, both families would meet and the boy and the girl never got any alone time to even talk to each other. But now, once the parents meet, usually what happens is the parents say, okay, you know what, now just let the kids talk to each other and let them decide whether they want to take this forward or not. Mm-hmm. So
that's a big change.
Yeah, it is a big change. Yeah. And I see that not just with my family, but with other families as well. So they allow the children to get to know each other a little better and then decide whether they want to get married or not.
Yeah.
But this time period is not very long. So under normal circumstances, if you meet someone, like on a blind date, you usually date them for a few months or maybe a year, a little over a year before you decide whether you want to get married or not. Parents are not happy to wait for a year. For them, time is running out, right? So they are not okay with two people spending a year together, spending so much time together, and then it not materializing into anything. So that time period is shorter. I think that's what...
So how short is this possible thing you're discussing now in modern times? Would it be a week or two to know the parents and then another couple weeks to know something and then it's over?
No. So I think hypothetically it would be a few months for me to get to know the boy and then say okay, yes or no. And then maybe they do like some sort of officiating ceremony. Where they say, okay, you know what, they're both going to be hitched.
Oh.
They exchange gifts, right? And
but the parents exchange gifts to parents, not the bride and the groom.
No. Okay. So basically, his parents will give me a gift, and we will give him a gift.
Oh, okay.
My family. So the families exchange gifts for the bride and groom, right? And they're not married. They're just.
Is it like engaged or?
It's sort of like engaged.
Pre-engaged.
It's like a pre-engaged thing. Okay. Yeah. And then after that, they can wait for another 6 months or another year, but they do want that pre-engaged thing. To know that, okay, you know what, we can stop looking elsewhere. That's their problem.
Okay.
That while you are talking to one person, they're not looking for other people.
Has this happened to you? Have you been to that point yet?
No. I haven't been to that pre-engagement officiating point
yet. Have boys come to your home?
Yes.
To eat or whatever?
No, it's extremely uncomfortable and awkward. These experiences turn into funny stories, but while you're in it, you hate it. Like, it's physically uncomfortable. Like, sometimes I've been nauseous just minutes before the family arrives, and I'm like, why do I have to do this? But it's a part of life. And
yeah. So I find this fascinating that there are these websites that parents go on to find a mate. Now, do young people also go on websites?
Yes, they do. So it's just that in my case, my profile has been set up by my parents because I don't care. But a lot of people set up their own profiles. They go through possible matches on their own. And a lot of people do it on their own, but I don't.
I can see the byline that her parents said, beautiful, you know, lovely, wonderful daughter, rebellious as all, get out. Bargain. Within the boundaries of the parents' wishes, let's take it further. What if they do decide to get married? Could you compare and contrast perhaps what your parents' marriage was like and then what you would prefer to have?
You mean a wedding?
A wedding, excuse me. Yes, a wedding, yes.
So weddings have also changed over time. Like, earlier weddings were, I think, a lot simpler. Maybe they had 2 or 3 ceremonies, which lasted.
That's simple.
Yeah, 2 or 3 ceremonies within the wedding, and which lasted maybe 2 days or 3 days. But now, weddings are an industry in India.
Oh, yes.
It is an industry because the functions just go on for days. And I can give you an example of one of our really close friends got married a couple of years ago, and she wanted to have a destination wedding, but
what's a destination?
Oh, destination wedding is when you travel out of the city, you go to the hills or you go to the beach, and you choose the destination for your wedding, but instead, for whatever reason, they had to have the wedding in Delhi, and they had 4 different functions. One was they had 5 functions on 5 different days. So you're drinking till the morning for 5 days in a row because, I mean, it's your closest friend's wedding and you can't just go home early. It's like you have to be there, right? And these were formal functions. Before this were times where we would meet for dance practices because both the girl side and the boy side have to put up dance performances. I'm telling you about the big fat Indian wedding, right? So they meet for dance practices where usually they hire a professional choreographer, but because all of us have been dancers, we choreographed her dance together. So we would meet for dance practices and there would be dinner and drinks after the dance practice as well. And there would be parties in the house all the time. There was family, her family and friends were over at her house all the time. We had a great time. So one function was called the youngsters function, which means all the kids, none of the parents, just the kids get together and drink.
At the house or?
Not at the house, but at either a club or a lounge or a bar, you can hire a space to do that. So that was one. The second one was the mehendi function where they put henna on the girls' hands and feet. Uh-huh. And I mean, anybody who's attending the function can also get henna put if they want. And just another excuse to dress up and eat and drink. So that's two. Number three was the cocktail, which is cocktail, by as the name suggests, it's where you just go and drink. That's where we performed. That's where we did our, showcased our dance performances. Number four was the actual wedding. And number five was a wedding reception. So this was 5 days.
5 days?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's even more number of days than Khmer weddings, I just realized.
I guess I know Bollywood more than I know India. Okay, your possible wedding then is what?
My possible wedding would not be in the city for sure. I think it would just be close friends and family who will take the trouble to travel, and just a small ceremony over 2 days, because there are certain things that you have to do as a part of the wedding process. Mm-hmm. So it cannot be less than 2 days.
Okay.
So day one is when the girls go to the boy's house and they give him some gifts, and there is some sort of a ceremony that is done by a priest.
Oh, okay.
And then, I mean, usually in the evening the family gets together and has dinner or drinks or whatever. One day when they put the henna, which is also sort of like a ceremony, and then the wedding, that's it.
Tell me about the henna. Is that something special?
Yeah, so
it comes off in a couple of days.
Yeah, it comes off, depending on how dark it is, it comes off in a week at the most. And it's like a temporary tattoo, and I honestly love it. I think it's the best part of our culture. I love it, and I love the smell. And
is it a beauty ritual, or does it have any other significance?
Does it tell a story?
Yeah, it does tell a story. So the boy's name is hidden in the girl's hand. The pattern that they draw on the hand is also sometimes, and they make beautiful patterns. Sometimes it's a bride and a groom drawn on the girl's hand. And they say that the darker the henna, the more the girl's mother-in-law is going to love her.
This is an insurance policy.
Yeah. So they see how dark the henna has become, and then they decide whether the mother-in-law is going to be happy or not.
So the young lady looks ahead and says, look, this is going to be a rough mother-in-law. Really make this dark.
Yeah. But you can't control it. It depends on the warmth in your skin and blood. It depends on the quality of the henna. It depends on how soon you wash it. Because after they put it, it dries up. And then you have to keep your hands warm if you want it to be dark. But with some people, it just doesn't get dark. Like my mother, her henna always comes up orange and mine goes black.
Tell our listeners whether we should come to India.
You absolutely should come to India. And I think there's such a diversity of terrain, kind of people, kind of food, places to see, that I haven't been able to cover everything in my own country. And I consciously spent the last 4 or 5 years traveling extensively within India, choosing a new place every time, so I can see more and more of it. And then move on to maybe going and seeing Europe, because I've never been to Europe, but there's just so much to see in India that I'm occupied with that all the time.
Thank you so much. Let's go to India.
You've wanted to go to India for years.
Thank you again, Ruchi.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening today. We hope you enjoyed Ruchika, her experiences, and her various thoughts. As she said, we should all visit India. You know, to gain more insight about the school that she was teaching in Cambodia, or some of the teachings with her students, and also a little bit about India, visit the website www.virtualsaguaro.com. That's VirtualSaguaro.com. You'll find pictures, maps, and links to enhance this podcast. Well, until then, this is Virtual Saguaro wishing you a great day.